think MOQs are not set. I think that they're scalable. So you can increase and you can decrease. And it depends really on some of the things we all just talked about and I just summarized. In food, you have something called closeout. So you have, as I said, that food expires. So once the expiration date is 3 months or below, most retailers, most distributors will not buy it.
Growing a business requires a holistic approach that extends beyond sales and marketing. This approach needs alignment among people, processes, and technologies. So if you're a business owner, operations, or finance leader looking to learn growth strategies from your peers and competitors, you're tuned into the right podcast. Welcome to the WBS Podcast, where scalable growth using business systems is our number one priority. Now, here is your host, Sam Gupta.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the WBS Podcast. I'm Sam Gupta, your host and principal consultant at independent ERP and digital transformation consulting firm, Elevate IQ. For an e-commerce business, inventory is everything. If you don't have enough inventory, you might lose on opportunities. If you have too much, your cash may be locked with the inventory. If you are working with vendors, they will not work with you unless you are willing to work with their preferred minimum order quantity. But those MOQs must make sense for your business as well. In fact, MOQ will drive your sales and product bundling, as well as you need to have enough margins and determine the appropriate MOQs that'll make sense for your business. In today's episode, we invited a panel of cross-functional experts for a live interview on LinkedIn who brings significant expertise to discuss MOQ and how to calculate it. We also discussed the differences in MOQ calculation for B2B versus B2C, the difference between MOQ and EOQ, and how MOQ calculation is different in the DTC world. Finally, we discussed the correlation of MOQ and time, the best practices of MOQ when multiple vendors may exist for the same SKU, and the magic formula for coming up with appropriate MOQs for both buying and selling. With that, let's get to the conversation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's show. And if you're joining for the first time, this is part of our e-commerce series, for which we meet every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. We pick one topic related to e-commerce, and we always have an expert panel that is willing to share their insights and wisdom. For today, we are going to be very exciting topic. It may not sound very exciting when you think of minimum order quantity. Okay, how big of a deal it could be, but actually it's a big deal. And that's exactly what we are going to learn today through our story. Before we do that, we are going to start with everybody's intros. And I am going to start with my intro. If you don't know me, I am Sam Gupta. I am principal at Elevate IQ. I have been in the ERP and e-commerce space for roughly 20 years. And minimum order quantity gives me a lot of trouble. So obviously, I have a lot of stories myself. As part of Elevate IQ, we are the independent ERP and digital transformation firm. We help our clients with the ERP selection, contract negotiation, business process re-engineering, enterprise architecture, business architecture, as well as ERP implementation. On that note, I am going to move to Chris. If she can introduce herself.
Yes, of course, Sam. Great to be here with everybody today. I am Chris Harrington, the president and COO of GenAlpha Technologies. We are a SaaS software solution company. We do digital commerce for original equipment manufacturers and aftermarket organizations. And Sam, I struggle with MOQ as well. I think many of the customers I've worked with over my lifetime, including being in manufacturing myself, MOQ is just one of those things that is so unique by business and by product line that I think everybody has questions and comments and thoughts on this topic. So it should be a fun one. Thank you.
And Chris, for today, my goal is going to be to find one person who feels comfortable around MOQ.
Yes, we all need to know that person.
Right. So I'm actually going to move to Laura. Laura, would you like to introduce yourself joining for the first time?
Hi, everybody. My name is Laura Lai. I'm a director at NewGen Architects. We are a consulting firm who specializes in supply chain technologies, processes, all that fun stuff in terms of how you get something from point A to point B and the technology that you can use to get there. So a little bit about just my background. I am new to the space, but my background really, to Sam's point, is really on the S&OP side. My background is in a function called planning. So you can imagine that is the crux of what we're talking about today. So I'm really excited to be able to share some personal stories on my experience planning around MOQs and what I got out of that whole process.
Yeah, and one of these days, hopefully I can figure out how to plan, to be honest. I just don't know how to plan. So thank you so much for being here, Laura. Okay, Steve, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here with Laura, Chris, and Juliet, though I don't know what Juliet looks like yet at the moment. My name is Steve Rice. I am the founder of Dotcom Jungle and the Globally Conscious Leader. I've been working with manufacturers for over 30 years, and we help companies make and implement wise technology choices. Sometimes we're working with the marketing team and developing HubSpot issues or APIs between websites and ERPs. Generally sit in the same place where CTOs and those types of folks sit. Some of our clients don't even have CTOs. So we end up working a lot with marketing teams and helping them understand their own pricing and the way things are boxed up and shipped out, stuff like that. So we do come across MOQ issues. And I think I might be a little more comfortable around it only because I try to get people not to freak out about it. They're like Chris said, there are a lot of different companies. Everybody's different. The math you can do is different. And my take is if you take it from the customer standpoint at the other end, you start asking them what they want, then you might actually you'll feel a little more comfortable about the numbers you arrive at, because you'll be servicing as well. So we'll talk about that as we.
And I was really counting on Steve, to be honest. I knew that he would probably feel comfortable. So thank you so much for being there for me. Juliet, I know you are having challenges with your camera, but that's okay. If you are able to speak, I would love to get the introduction.
Thank you, Sam. And hi, everybody. You can go on LinkedIn and you can see what I look like, but I definitely have problems with my camera. I, like Laura, I'm new to this team. And thank you, Sam, so much for inviting me. I'm the CIO and head of supply chain of a food and beverage company that essentially sells third-party brands in the United States exclusively. So I deal with minimum order quantities from my supplier. So they basically put MOQs on us. And then we also calculate MOQs as far as our retail business. But particularly what I think is interesting is a direct-to-consumer and e-commerce business. And how do you calculate that and what is the best way to get to the proper MOQ? So I'm excited to talk about all of this with all of you.
And I am super excited to hear those stories as well, Juliet. People might perceive that you are a bit shy because you don't have your camera on, but you are not going to be shy with your story. So thank you so much for being here, Juliet.
That is true. Thank you.
Amazing. Love it. All right, guys. So if you are joining for the first time in the audience, make sure you guys comment because we are going to be covering each of your questions and comments during the show. If we cannot get to them, within time, our panelists will make sure that you get your answers. On that note, I am going to start with Chris with the first question. And that is going to be just setting the stage overall. If people don't know what minimum order quantity is, and to be honest, a lot of startups don't really know unless they are going to work with a vendor who is going to push them, hey, I cannot work with you because we have MOQ, and they are going to feel, okay, what is that? So do you want to set the stage in terms of minimum order quantity and why it matters when you look at different perspectives, whether you are talking about e-commerce, manufacturers, there are going to be many different perspectives of the MOQ. Chris, over to you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sam. I think that if I were to sum up the biggest reason why it's important, starting with that, is that for manufacturers and or suppliers, the right MOQ affects profitability. So they're thinking about profitability. If we go to the end user or customer, they're thinking about cost and the cost benefit analysis of how many they might have to purchase against the needs or the demand of what they really have. So if I can put this into practice as well, to just kind of walk through a scenario in the industries that I work with. So if you look at a manufacturer of a sweeper, so think about a sweeper unit that comes behind a parade. So, you know, there's some horse droppings that happen at the parade. And behind this parade, there's the sweepers that clean things up on the road. So manufacturers manufacture those sweepers. So what happens with a sweeper is that the brushes are the consumable at the end of the sweeper that are actually doing the work of cleaning. Okay. Now, most sweeper manufacturers, they don't manufacture the brushes. They purchase the brushes from a supplier and then they add them to the units before they leave the factory. Okay. And typically, because this is a consumable item, that supplier to the manufacturer will typically have an MOQ, like a pallet worth of brushes. That might mean thousands of brushes that will come in packages to the manufacturer, and they're going to add them to the number of units they're manufacturing in any given month or time period. We'll call it a month. And it's going to cover how many the manufacturer sells to their distribution network and then to the end user who owns the sweeper. Okay, so there's a minimum order quantity to the manufacturer, and typically that manufacturer can absorb a higher MOQ. Maybe they have to buy those 1,000 units because they have a high level of production and they have the opportunity to sell through their distributor. So they can buy at higher MOQ levels because of their opportunity. So, and usually their standard cost is lower when they're buying 1,000 units from that supplier than, you know, 500 units. So they have an opportunity to manage their costs there as well. So that comes into the manufacturer. Now, when the manufacturer sells through distribution, because oftentimes they're selling to all the distributors in their network, those distributors typically can't buy because they 1,000 units. So they don't go back to that supplier. They're coming back to the manufacturer who built the sweeper. And they might have a lower MOQ. It might be as low as 50 or 25, but that dealer can handle it because that's about as much inventory he or she can handle, and then is going to sell to the actual individuals or companies that own those sweepers. So there is an MOQ from the manufacturer to the distributor. And now this distributor has a lower volume of MOQ that they've purchased in this stream of the supply chain. And now the end user might be able to buy one, but typically in a consumable product, they're also going to have an MOQ. And that MOQ might be the number of brushes that are on one unit of the sweeper. So if that sweeper has 8 brushes, the package might be you have to buy 8. We're not going to sell you the one, because then the profitability for all the different players in that chain of events would suffer if I tried to sell you one. First, you might not even buy it from me. The cost would be too high. Or for me to sell it to you at a price that you would pay, the market price, I wouldn't make any money as that dealer. So hopefully what I'm describing through words is a good example of where MOQ kind of plays out in a supply chain as it comes down to the end user. So you have high volumes of goods to the end user who owns the product that would never buy 1,000. He or she has one sweeper or two, and they can't afford that. But through that process, there are levels of MOQ that go through that supply chain. So that's kind of a story that I thought would help set up how MOQ plays out through the different sales channels.
Yeah, love the story, by the way. I mean, the story cannot be as simple as just talking about sweeping and sweepers, to be honest. I mean, amazing story. It's so relatable. Okay, but what I really wanted to get from you is going to be the B2B world. So I knew that Laura and Juliet, they are going to talk a lot about the B2C. But yeah, in the B2B world, I don't know how much MOQ matters, because in the B2C world, we know that it's very, very, very hard to predict the demand. Sure, you can go to historical data, you can probably predict using that. But in your B2B world, in the machines, the kind of equipment that you are selling, in your world, That's going to happen, let's say, every 10 years, 20 years. And then each of that equipment is actually going to drive the MOQs for each of the part that your machine contains, right? So now in this scenario, I don't know whether in the B2B world, it is going to be harder to predict your MOQs or is it easier? From your experience, what have you seen, Chris, in the B2B versus B2C?
Well, in the world that I play in, and let's talk about e-commerce. So traditionally, manufacturers were selling to distributors and they could have higher MOQs because distributors held inventory and sold to a lot of users. Now, when the manufacturer has their own e-commerce site and they're opening up direct to the end user, the manufacturer does struggle with this because historically they've had the higher MOQ for their distributors. And right. Now they have to think about how am I going, what are my logistics and what are my overhead costs for that, the 8 versus selling the 25 or 50 or whatever it might be to your distributor. So yes, it does come up. It's a problem that many of them are trying to solve as more and more manufacturers are moving direct to end users, still leveraging their distribution channels, but opening up that customer experience for that user to buy direct from the manufacturer. So it absolutely comes up and it is a challenge. Calculations of what they've calculated in the past are now new because they have to think about the end user. So that's how I would describe it.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much, Chris, for those insights. So Laura, I am actually going to come to you and I think the sweeping story is going to be hard to beat, but I'm pretty sure you have a lot more stories to share. So when you are thinking about the MOQ and the minimum order quantity, and I don't know if you're going to have anything to add there in terms of setting the stage, but from the planning perspective, in my experience, it's a nightmare. So tell us why MOQ matters in your world and what are the challenges that you have seen?
Well, to kind of bring it back to just setting the stage for the MOQ, when you first brought up this topic, a number of questions came to my mind and I went right back to my planner seat and was starting to think through what is the checklist of like, why are we trying to achieve this MOQ? What's the purpose?
Yep.
So when I step back and I think about MOQs in general, there's a variety of questions that come to mind in terms of what goal we're trying to achieve at the end of the day. So to reiterate, my background is really in retail apparel. So a lot of my examples will be, let's talk about this sweater. Let's talk about your polo shirt, Sam. So a lot of those will come through. But when I think about it in that world, when I think of MOQ, I think of a lot of things. One, or questions to ask, is the goal of this MOQ, is the goal of this product to test a new similar product offering? Or just a new product in general for your product assortment to your customer? Is it to test a new product with different attributes, different prices, different qualities, because you're trying to understand what the demand potential is for this particular product, because you just don't know? Is it to potentially test a new vendor's capability? So again, in my background, we would work with different factories to produce specific garments. Well, hello, supply chain, you might want to diversify where your product is coming from. So as a proactive strategy, you might be wanting to engage with different vendors and understand what their capabilities are. So is the MOQ really just to satisfy a test run for this upstream supplier? Question mark. Is it maybe to test another part of the business? Is it to stress test how warehouse operations actually can kick in? Like you're maybe used to working with thousands and thousands of units of something, but maybe something needs to change. What is their operational excellence in terms of handling potentially MOQs of maybe 50 or something of that nature that coming into their warehouse situation? Is it maybe to test a different kind of customer experience? So I know this is not an e-commerce experience, but maybe if you're in a store and you wanted to start offering chapstick at the register, maybe you just want to buy a few just to test out what that customer experience looks like. So when I think of it in that sense, there's a lot of reasons why you want to introduce the concept of MOQs to your business. Going back to the e-commerce side, as I formerly worked on the e-commerce side of a brick and mortar partner, oftentimes the e-commerce website was asked to test different products for your brick and mortar locations. So it was an easy way to understand the demand potential for specific product before there was a larger investment for the entire fleet of the brick and mortar space. So when I think of it in that sense, you know, there's a lot to think about. How am I going to make sure that this MOQ doesn't get lost on the website? Is it going to need special support? How do I make sure this MOQ is set up for success if I'm really trying to test its scalability for a partner? And at the end of the day, you know, it all boils down to, as a planner, what is the MOQ's financial profile? What kind of price point am I selling it at? What kind of margin could I expect on a good day versus a bad day? What kind of carrying costs am I going to have to account for? Am I using my money to buy this MOQ versus invest it in a product that has a known track record? So in my head, to kind of set the stage here from an MOQ standpoint, really for me, from a planning standpoint, it's really thinking about, what am I trying to achieve from this MOQ? And how does that drive into my strategy and my calculation for what we need to buy and what we want to buy for the customer or what we want to read at the end of the day?
Love it. So I think there's going to be a little bit of tie here with respect to the chopstick story and the sweeping story, to be honest. So good job, Laura, with respect to story. Now, you know, when you are breaking it down overall in terms of minimum order quantity, and you described a lot of different layers. So I am going to narrate a story from my perspective. So when I speak to a lot of different planners, especially in the S&OP community, some of them, they are going to recommend, you know what, if you are going to be testing at the product level, then what is going to happen is that is just too detailed. So you should be testing at the category level, they are going to recommend. But we have also seen the problems with the other planners where, let's say, at the category level, you might be okay, but you are actually missing the white shirt that is in high demand. So I don't know how to manage the MOQ when you are going to be really detailed in the fashion world, in the apparel world, the world you come from. So what would be your recommendation when you are planning for MOQ? Would you plan at the category level? Would you plan at the item level? Or would you plan at the attribute level?
Oh, it so depends, Sam, on the situation. Maybe I'll come up with a couple of different examples of why you might have a situation for both cases.
Yeah.
So one I think about is, I'll use an example of an MOQ situation I had a few years back.
Yeah.
I used to work in menswear apparel. One of the products that we wanted to bring into the assortment was a sequin blazer, because why not, right? Now, so you would argue, well, I could plan at the total blazer category. And what is the actual like minimum order quantity of blazer demand that I want to bring in? You could look at it from that perspective. But when you think about the attribute of the sequin blazer, that's a completely different beast. So you might want to be looking at it from that standpoint at the item level and what the MOQ is from a manufacturing standpoint. What is the bare minimum factory run that that a factory will provide for you in order to produce this sequin blazer? So oftentimes, part of the negotiation, the decision-making process is understanding what your supplier partners can actually do for you. What is truly their break-even or lowest level of commitment they want to produce for you? So in the world of manufacturing, that really generally runs into a factory line situation or how many hours they are willing to dedicate to producing this garment for you. And they will be able to come back and say, like, our MOQ from a labor and raw material standpoint would be at least 100 garments. So from that perspective, you are gathering a lot of pieces of information to determine what kind of MOQ decision making you want to have and what that raw number is at the end of the day.
Okay, amazing insight. Thank you so much, Laura, for that. So Steve, I am actually going to come to you. So let's say if you were to set the stage, and I don't know if you're going to have any better story, but it's going to be really hard to beat the sweeping as well as the chopstick story. But Steve always has amazing stories, so I think he have, you know, slightly better, but we'll see how that goes. So any stories, any stories related to MOQ, you want to set the stage related to MOQ?
Well, I chatted, there are a lot of reasons why you would have MOQs, or at least there are two general rules why you would have them.
Yeah.
Generally, I think most of us understand conceptually, like any listener here would know, like if they went to go buy letterhead or envelopes, the printing industry is one of those areas that has MOQs. And they have MOQs because it just takes time to set that up and everything's custom, right? But I think the challenge here for manufacturers is that my experience is most manufacturers think they need to have MOQs because they look around and they think everybody else has them. And I don't think most of them actually need. There are stories I can give from the apparel industry, and it sounds like Laura and I need to connect offline. But inside the outdoor industry, there are examples of vendors using minimum order quantity, like across the entire brand, to say you have to spend this amount of money This is an example of how to do it wrong. Because if you're in a relationship with a manufacturer, it's supposed to be a relationship. But what they basically said is you have to spend this amount of money if you want to be part of our family of people and have access to what you should have access to all the time, which is something like on the website, a feature like buy from a shop near you. I won't even get the company, but a couple of them have done it where they said, you know, our minimum order quantities are X. So if you're Bob's Fishing Tackle or Ashton Outdoor Store, you know, which I used to own, this actually happened to me, and you don't order enough, we're not going to put you on our map. And so, but they had set these bars so high that the only people that were allowed on their map were REI, Nordstrom's, and Walmart. And so they basically created a policy that rejected the majority of their specialty retailers without saying, we're only going to sell online, you know, to through our system to these three manufacturers. That's an example of what not to do in terms of, you know, B2 relation. But getting back to, if you're a manufacturer and you know you're selling to consumers, you're often not going to have an MOQ, right? Your margin should be enough that you're making a big enough margin, or you're having the customer pay for shipping. But if you're going to direct, if you're going B2B, my take is, if you as a manufacturer, one of the reasons you really want to do MOQs might not be for a total MOQ amount, but more for like an MOQ minimum quantity in batches, meaning you're going to go negotiate with UPS or USPS and find out what their box size is where you can get the best rate sort of per volume. And you might try to figure out how many things can we put in that box. And you might say we can put 4 and we can get our discounted rate. And so now it's not as much of MOQ as much as it is a minimum quantity order amount. So you can order 4, 8, 12, 16, or whatever. That's, I think, when I said that's why I don't stress out about it so much and I'm more comfortable with it. I think most manufacturers who are selling to retail stores should be thinking about it like that, because you're doing it for the customer experience. You're doing it to save them shipping. You're doing it to save you shipping. And you're not creating, you know, if you're into the theory of constraints and you set up really high minimum order quantities when you shouldn't, you might actually be creating a huge cash flow problem for yourself. And you could run yourself out of business when you think you're doing the right thing by creating minimum order quantities. But if you create box quantities, everybody wins. So
very interesting insights and perspective. And I am probably going to have the follow-up question, the point that Chris mentioned related to the DTC, because you actually play in the DTC world. So she mentioned that, you know, the whole game of MOQ is changing, because MOQ was slightly easier when you had to deal with 100 distributors. But now you are probably dealing with a million consumers, you know? So how is the MOQ changing in your perspective when the manufacturers are, let's say, trying to go deep, Steve?
Well, sometimes it's going away entirely. For instance, I have a client who used to have MOQs for all of their dealers. One of their dealers was Cabela's. And Cabela's came back to them and said, look, we have you in all X number of our stores and we sell a ton and we order a ton, but we're tired of your MOQs because we want you to drop ship. So if you don't drop ship, which means we want your MOQ to be 1 now, they're saying you can trust us that we're going to still populate our stores with your products, but we're negotiating with you to make your MOQ 1 because we want you to drop ship. So there's a really good example of how, like, basically the entire world has changed. They know they're already shipping from their warehouses when they have it in stock, if they can, but they also know that sometimes they won't have it in stock and they don't want to have an employee, say at the Springfield store, walk out onto the sales floor, grab a box, go in the back, box is inefficient. So there's an example of MOQ going away because, you know, went the other direction. The retailer was like, hey, wait a second, I'm not going to do that. And the client was forced to comply. And there was a negotiation around pricing and drop ships like that to make it reasonable. But if you have a good relationship with your dealers, then you can.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much, Steve, for those insights. And Juliet, I'm actually going to come to you, and you are probably going to have a million stories there just because the kind of things that you have seen in your life. So just to set the stage related to minimum order quantity, what would you say to that?
So thank you for that level of energy, Sam. I just love that. I think that very interesting and very detailed comments have been covered. What I want to bring to the table is sort of the company that I'm working with, we're in a lot of different channels. We're in the food service channel. We're in the retail channel. We're in the distributor channel, and we're also in the consumer channel. So when you think about how you sell your product in all those different channels, you know, for retail and for distributor, you really don't have a minimum order quantity in terms of how we sell out. So again, I want to say sell out and also buy, right? There's minimum order quantities of buying, and then there's minimum order quantities on selling. And I'm going to talk about the selling side. We can go back to the buying as well, but I'm just talking about the out, right? So for distributors and for retailers, we really didn't see issues with minimum order quantities because people were buying in pallets or in layers. And so that was never an issue. And don't forget, we're in the high-end food business. We also have to consider, expiration dates and the life of the product. So it's a little bit more complex. However, when you sell to the consumer, you really have to know sort of the turn of that product. So we really don't go to the consumer market only with those products that turn very, very well. They have really good margins. And then the question is, how do you sell to the consumer? So you either do direct to consumer, or you go through Amazon, which is another option. And Amazon has two ways to sell. They have one way to sell through Vendor Central, where you literally sell your inventory from your company to Amazon. You sell it, so you sell in bulk, so there's no minimum order quantity, really. I mean, they do define it, but it's really not an issue. And then they price it to the consumer because they sell it. The Amazon Central model is I move my inventory into an Amazon place, but it's still my inventory, and I control the price to the consumer. So I can price it any way I want. And that is when, I go back to Steve's comment in terms of how we ship, in boxes and also on the different platform, on the direct-to-consumer platform, it's very, very important to understand your shipping costs and at which point you break even, and then what is the demand and the supply, so what can you really price it at? And also, what's the consumption of that product, right? So you have to look at all those factors. What is the consumption rate? How are you relative to your competitors? So you want to price it right, and then work backwards and see, what is your minimum order quantity required for you to at least break even or to make the margin. When I say break even, meaning you can make the margins that you want to make. So it's quite complex on the outgoing side. On the incoming side, for our food business, we really didn't have issues in terms of minimum order quantity, other than certain suppliers, because most of our product is coming from overseas. And so you can imagine that during the pandemic, there have been issues in procuring that material, in procuring pasta, in procuring whatever, right? All other foods that we bought, that there were issues. So a very good supply chain strategy is to have more than one supplier. You always want to have a backup. And that's when your minimum order quantity issues come into play, because the question is really how much are you willing to buy of that particular SKU. So depending on the SKU and depending on the turns of the product, you may or may not have an issue. Most of our product was not an issue. Some of our product that had lower turns or they had thinner margins, those are the products where we had to consider if the supplier had MOQs, then we really had to kind of think about that and think about whether we want to have one vendor or more than one vendor, because we were already having difficulty meeting the MOQs. But it's more rare than it's for us, it wasn't a big issue on the buying side. On the selling side, it is.
Okay, very, very interesting insights here. And I'm glad that you are bringing the scenario about the incoming products and multiple vendors the play of MOQs when you are going to have multiple vendors. So the follow-up question I'm going to have for you, and this is going to be slightly into the ERP world, in the supply chain world, when you are going to have multiple vendors for your SKU, and I don't know who is going to have negotiation power. My assumption is going to be there going to be a little bit of play in terms of negotiation. Sometimes you might be working with very powerful vendors and you might not have a control on your MOQs. But let's say if you have your suppliers and 1, 2, 3, that the rank that you are maintaining, and they might have each of their MOQs. So now when the algorithm is going to kick in, when you are ordering something, typically you are going to go with your rank one vendor if you are trying to automate some of those rules. But based on MOQ, it might go to vendor number one, vendor number three. So yeah. Juliet, in your experience, have you seen any challenges there? Any best practices that you might be able to provide overall the vendor ranking and the MOQs related to them?
Yeah. So, you know, the one example that I can think of is pasta, and okay. We buy enriched pasta. So, like I said, our products are high-end products. They go into Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. So they're the best. And so, you know, we buy enriched pasta, and a lot of vendors and a lot of suppliers do not sell enriched pasta. So if you go to the supermarket, you should read the label and you should figure out what's enriched and what's not. And enriched is a lot healthier because it's got a lot more vitamins and so on. So we buy enriched pasta from Italy. Because most people do not buy enriched pasta, their production is mostly non-enriched pasta. So the enriched one is like special line, it's a special production line. So now they have MOQs, right? So first of all, one comment I wanted to make is this business is very much a relationship business as well. So sometimes they will do things for you because of the relationship and because you've been with them for many years. The second issue is you may have enriched pasta, you know, with spinach, with mushrooms, with whatever. So you may have, let's say, 12 SKUs you want that manufacturer to make for you. And you may not be able to meet the MOQs for all. So you may have to make decisions around, okay, I'm going to drop the mushroom pasta, but I'm going to do the spinach pasta, right? So now you're going to consolidate, you know, the minimum order quantity with, you know, with the number of SKUs that you have. So those are some best practices that you could do. And clearly, if you cannot meet the MOQs or you're very close to them, you clearly cannot have more than one supplier because you just can't sustain it. That's it. You know, so you have to make decisions. You know, do you want the pasta to be enriched? Do you want to have all these different flavors? So those are the decisions that you have to make.
Okay, amazing insights here. Thank you so much, Juliet, for that. So Chris, I am going to come to you for the next segment. And next segment is going to be really finding out that magic formula for the MOQ for each of the products that you may be buying or selling. So how would you come up with the minimum order quantity for the products that you are buying or selling, Chris?
Yeah, Kip, I was hoping we could just keep talking about pasta. But actually, I think Laura and Juliet brought up some of the items that you would think about in the calculation of MOQ kind of in their stories already. But, you know, I think what I would just highlight in the businesses that I work with, demand is a really important metric to determine what kind of MOQ is even reasonable from that your customer perspective. So if we go back to the sweeper story, if there's 8 brushes on a sweeper, right? If I look at my demand, are they typically ordering 8, 16, 24? Because if there's a high, you know, 90% or more, I'm selling 8 or more, or 8 or multiples of 8, then I can probably save on a lot of things, my packaging, so my demand historically is going to be a really important calculation for that. Certainly cost to either produce or cost to purchase. So in the story I told, the manufacturer did not produce the brushes. They had to buy them from a supplier. So, and the supplier may have constraints on you. Now they could potentially be negotiated, but those, what are my true costs, are going to be an element that need to be evaluated. And then the market price. So what price does the market bear for me establishing an MOQ and what my price point is? Now, I will tell you that I agree with Steve. There's a lot of products that MOQ is not going to make sense for, right? Where I have historically seen it is in consumables and or call it hardware, right? We as a manufacturer, we used to get these odd orders where somebody would order 2 bolts, right? And they'd want us to ship 2 bolts to them. And 2 bolts, the cost to package, get that ready, have our pick, pack, and ship. Let's just talk about the administrative overhead costs to sell two bolts. And maybe the cost of the bolt was 5 cents, but the actual amount of time it took and the cost to prepare that order was so much that we decided to increase the price. So if you were going to buy individual bolts, we're happy to sell them to you, but we had a minimum price of $2 each, right? So if your customers are willing to pay because they really only want the two bolts, and for a hardware item, maybe they're willing to buy and only pay $4 because it's a lower price item and it's not going to cause a lot of red flags. So they're going to say, yes, I'll pay $4 for two bolts. And we were willing to go ahead and do that. So we didn't set the minimum order quantity, but we set a price point that still allowed us to make a margin. You see where I'm going with this? So there's a cost and an MOQ consideration here. And it goes back to, what are my customers willing to do? Are they willing to pay a little more and get the quantity that they need? Or are they demanding that they have a lower cost per unit, and therefore I need to sell them more in order to handle that? So that's a big part of the evaluation.
I want to point out one of the largest distributors in the specialty outdoor retail industry has a very successful program sort of along these lines. And they basically came to it because they talked to their retailers, because they said, look, it doesn't make any sense for us to give you free shipping on an item. Right. Mm-hmm. And so they came up with kind of a tiered program. You can place an order at any time, whether it's a preseason or an ASAP. And if it's, I think it's over $250, they'll cover the shipping because they know they get these big bulk rates from Red Away and everybody else. And sometimes, you know, these orders can be $5,000 to $30,000 for a bunch of accessories. But if you really want something for a customer and it's $49, like, they're going to charge you $25 for it just because it's one thing. And they expect you to talk to your customer and let them know that maybe if you want to pass it on to your customer, you can. If you want to eat it and call it a customer service thing at the cash register in the hopes that they'll spend another $200, they have that choice too. But it almost completely eliminated their complaints department when they went to something like that. There are a few smaller shops who are like, God, I have to pay $25 to get this vested. But for the most part, they said, yeah, I get it. You know, I know how much it costs to ship. It costs the same $12 to ship something as it does $12 to ship something four times as big. You know, so that's a success story that I think is noting.
Okay, so very interesting story, Chris. And by the way, let me see, that's not fair at all, to be honest. I absolutely hate it because I'll tell you my story. Where, you know, so you are saying that I'm not going to have minimum order quantity because people hate minimum order quantity. But then I am going to make price so unfriendly, and I don't know how that is going to come across as the customer experience. Okay. So I, as you know, we subscribe to a lot of different software as a service platform. So if you are subscribing to any of the platform these days, if you look at the way they are pricing, if you are going to be signing up for the monthly subscription, they are going to increase the price almost double. Can you believe that? Okay. And that kills me, to be honest. I don't know how fair that is and how that is perceived more from the customer experience perspective. So I don't know if you're going to have any sort of follow-up comments, MOQ versus price so unfriendly that people are probably going to hate you.
Yeah, well, that's why I think this has to be evaluated by product. And that's why I talked about the hardware and the $2, right? So you might be willing to pay $4, you only need the two bolts. But now if we're talking about $40 for something that you would expect to be something less, or $1,000, now, you know, there are different price points for the types of people that are buying. And that's why you have to consider people who are purchasing and the product that you're selling. As Sam, you know, I'm a farmer here and I have chickens outside. If I sold one egg to 12 different families, imagine my time invested to sell one egg. I'm going to charge more per one egg than at some point, it just makes more sense to buy the dozen eggs, right? And so it's easier for me to sell a dozen eggs to one family to try to figure out the right price point for my time to keep selling one egg, right? And I know that's a sloppy example, but it is an example of life, and it's how we get to MOQs. It's how we end up bundling products to give and leverage everybody's value, right? So hopefully I've saved the family's value by giving them 12 and they don't have to run to the grocery store or to the local farmer every time they need an egg, right? But we all win. And I think that's why you have to communicate, you have to evaluate, you have to do the analysis, and why it is so important to look at the actual products, the variability of byproduct when you're deciding these.
And by the way, thank you so much for bringing that underlying rationale. And the only reason why a minimum order quantity exists is just because of that reason, to be honest. Yeah. That's why it came to light. So thank you so much, Chris, for that. So Laura, I'm actually going to come to you. Magic formula. You have been a planner and you know how difficult this is. Magic formula for minimum order quantity at both ends, buying and selling.
So from a buying, I'll focus on from the buying standpoint, because I'm thinking about buying upstream from the supplier to generate downstream revenue. So I'll touch upon that in a second. So when I think about at that product level to generate what an MOQ is, I always start with a comp idea. So when I say comp, a comparison. So if I'm talking about that Sequin Blazer example for a second, I'm trying to figure out what the MOQ is on that. I'm probably going to look for what is the craziest trend-ish blazer I've had in my sales history as a starting point to get to that concept of demand, what Chris talked about a second ago. Because without that as a starting point, then I can just whip out any number out of the air to define what an MOQ could look like. So when I do that kind of research, I'm really looking at that product level comparison to understand what that baseline forecast could look like from a demand standpoint. Then, you know, I'm thinking about, well, how long do I want to have this thing last for? Is this Sequin Blazer a seasonal situation? Do I want to have it for 6 months out of the year, or do I want this thing year round? So just as important as determining your quantities is, like, how long do you want the stuff? How long do you want to invest in this stuff? What is your carrying cost? How much do you want to invest up front? Because you have a certain expectation of how long you want that product available for. So the next thing I do is I layer on some sort of time dimensionality. So what is the historical performance? I layer on some sort of time component. And specifically when it comes to things like supply chain, you have to consider in lead times. Like, am I going to be able to buy this product frequently because this product is readily available upstream at my suppliers or my vendors? Or is this like a one and done situation? So I better be really thoughtful about making sure that my calculation is right up front. And then from that standpoint, then I do some magical division to assume just kind of what sell through rate I want. You know, if I know what my demand is and I know how long I want this to sell for, then I'm saying, like, on a good day, I want to sell through about 90% of what I want to buy. So that leaves me with 10%, you know, liquidation. So I have less of a risk, if you will, in terms of profitability and saleability at the end of life. So then I also look through, like, what is my tolerance on how long I want to sell this for and what my sell-through rate is. And voila, that's my number. Thinking about the sales side of it, that's when I really go back to, like, what Chris was saying in terms of the cost component and, like, what other levers you can have to help offset what that raw unit volume is. So if I come up with my magic number, it's 500 units of the Sequin Blazer, the supplier might say, hey, I can do it for you, but it's going to cost the company this much. And I'll consider that. And I will layer in things like, what is the ticketing strategy I want to do? What kind of margin am I willing to drop to or target to set that sales price at? So if I want to do a 50% margin on this product, and maybe the category is at a 60, but I want to test this product, I'm willing to give it a little bit of runway here. I will play with pricing to figure out how I offset this investment in this MOQ, even though it's costing the company a little bit more. So, you know, I think about it in that sense of, like, time dimensionality, how much I want to be left with at the end of its life cycle. And just, you know, what can I do from, like, a ticketing standpoint to make sure from a profitability standpoint, I'm not giving it away because the investment from an MOQ standpoint did cost a little bit more upfront.
Okay. And I love talking to planners because, you know, I think you have had 500 KPIs there in 5 minute segments. And I don't know whether people are going to be familiar with, you know, things like sell through rate.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain what sell through rate is, to be honest?
Yeah. So, and in the very simplistic form, like, if you buy 100 units of something, you want a 90% sell through, you want to say, I sold 90% of those units at full price. And maybe 10 of those units I have to discount or liquidate in some other form. So it's a goalpost on how you want to back into how much inventory you want to buy based off of an expected run rate or sales rate. So it's basically a way to control how many units you buy based off of these real life sort of expectations on weekly sales, length of time, et cetera. So you are layering in a lot of factors, but really from a math standpoint, it just becomes simple division on once you establish what those baseline expectations are.
Love it. Thank you so much, Laura, for that. Steve, I'm actually going to come to you. The magical formula for minimum order quantity, buying or selling.
I just have to say, I don't think there is one.
Okay.
I think if you're, the way I would put it, if you're a manufacturer, you want to maximize every sale that you make while maintaining a relationship and a business model that makes sense for your customers, and leave it at that. If you can raise your prices a dollar and the market can absorb that, and you're not going to be, doing something unethical, then you should do it.
Okay. Amazing insights there. So I know that, we already have too many KPIs and too many terms there. And in the comments, Steve, I can see you have thrown one more term there, which is going to be EOQ. So let's say if people are not familiar with what EOQ is, do you want to describe that?
So it stands for economic order quantity. And it was actually something that was invented by some guy named Ford Harris in 1913. And yes, I did look that up to make sure I had that info correct. I'm an encyclopedia about some things, but not that. And it's really, it's a way to figure out what the ideal order quantity for a company should be to purchase and minimize inventory costs, holding costs, everything else. It's exactly sort of what we're talking about. It's morphed into minimum order quantity. The problem with EOQ is sort of like an environmental theory. Sorry, not environmental, business theory. The major limitation is that it assumes that the demands for the company's product is constant over time. The demand for everything is constant. So the real world took over and said, I'm not sure that really works, right? So then people started thinking about minimum order quantity and thinking about it differently. And of course, even since then, I keep mentioning constraint theory, the theory of constraints and throughput accounting, which if your job in a manufacturing facility is to get the most out of the employees in the amount of time that they're there. And if you're not making the most money off of that, and once again, without being unethical, promote a lack of ethics, that's what the facility is there to do, is to make money now and in the future. And minimum order quantities, even theoretically, have a very little effect on whether you are lean and running efficiently and producing products in any individual factory with a high contributed margin. But that's usually the reason that manufacturers and marketing people and CEOs say, we got to have MOQs so we can run at capacity. That's usually a sign that someone doesn't really understand manufacturing, and they probably need to go down onto the manufacturing floor and talk to the production manager to find out how to run. I'm not saying MOQs are bad. I'm saying they're often implemented for the wrong reason to get to the wrong goals because they don't understand what the actual.
Love it. Thank you so much, Steve, for that. So, Juliet, I'm actually going to come to you. Magical formula for MOQs, buying or selling.
Yeah. So enjoyed literally listening to all these things and taking away little nuggets from everyone. I totally agree with Steve's ultimate comment about, the economic order quantity versus the minimum order quantity. And people have mentioned very key things, lead times. So for me, that was very important. All my product is coming from overseas. Lead times is key. You would set different EOQs or MOQs for different products, right? Depending on what the product is. We talked about a slew of products on this panel, and it's going to be different for every kind of a product. The workload to sell that product, that's a big item for the food. And I think it's a big item for everything. So sometimes there's soft costs and then there's hard costs. And we know what the hard costs are, but there's soft costs as well. And so if it's not worth it for you to sell it, then you have to put a minimum order quantity. And in our situation in food, that was true for certain SKUs, certain products. And then we talked about, I guess sell through, I call it turns, different people call it different ways. But at the end of the day, it's how much are you really selling? And what is the turn of that in your inventory? And that also drives, the calculation and this magical formula. And then I think Laura talked about demand. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. Demand, consumption rate, and supply. They're all pieces of MOQ, of pricing. And then lastly, I think MOQs are not set. I think that they're scalable. So you can increase and you can decrease. And it depends really on some of the things we all just talked about and I just summarized. In food, you have something called closeout. So you have, as I said, that food expires. So once the expiration date is 3 months or below, most retailers, most distributors will not buy it because they have to sell it to the end consumer as well. And there's time associated with that. So, you know, my MOQ is going to be smaller for those products that are coming close to what I call a closeout. So there's so many factors involved that you have to really look at. And I think, you know, we all discuss different pieces of that because we all come from different industries. You know, I just think it was a very interesting conversation. I took away a bunch of nuggets. Hopefully everybody else did as well. And again, Sam, thank you so much for having us and asking the magical question. There's no magical formula.
Okay, amazing. So I am going to have quick follow-up question for you, Juliet. That is going to be layering the lead time. So I don't know how many people really understand, you know, how lead time really relate to MOQ. Do you want to quick on that?
Yes. So obviously, you know, we're getting products from overseas and it takes a certain amount of time for that product to get here. So Laura being S&OP, and I also ran S&OP, you cannot forecast anything in the next 2 months because I can't affect it. So you can tell me you need product next month. I cannot get it for you because the ocean freight is 8 weeks. So it takes me 8 weeks to get it here. Right. You know, when I know that something is 8 weeks or 12 weeks or there's a risk in what I'm getting, you know, I may want to bring in more. So, for example, Trump put in some tariffs, if you remember. So the tariffs really increased, you know, our costs. So how can I kind of avoid or delay those tariffs or those costs? I want to bring in more product. If I bring in more product, you know, then I keep more inventory, but you know I'm gonna have a better pricing, and so when the price goes up to the retailer or to the consumer, I make a better margin. All right, let's put it this way: I don't lose a margin. So you know, here the minimum order quantity, you know, I will order more than the minimum order quantity, right? So here's where the minimum order quantity is scalable.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much, Juliet, for that. So the only thing we can take right now is going to be closing advice. So Chris, just a couple of words, any closing advice?
Yeah, we want to be profitable. So we have to think about what will our customers bear? What does the market bear? And it's going to be a mix of price and volume. And that's what we have to really analyze.
Love it. Thank you so much, Chris. Laura, just a few words, closing advice.
Yeah, I think just be really clear on what kind of MOQ you're going after. What are you trying to solve for? Because you can't solve for it all. So what is that one thing that you want to protect and solve for? What's the goal?
Love it. Thank you so much, Laura. Steve, just a few words, please.
The goal is to make money now and in the future through contributed margin and throughput.
Okay, amazing. Love it. Thank you so much, Steve. Juliet, just a few words.
What is the balance between sales and profitability?
Love it. Thank you so much, guys. That's it for today. If you joined for the first time, this was part of our e-commerce series for which we meet every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. We pick one topic related to commerce. So we are going to be here with a new topic next week. So make sure you are not going to miss next show. On that note, thanks everybody for your time and insights today.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks,
Chris.
Thank you, guys.
I cannot thank our guests enough for coming on the show, for sharing their knowledge and journey. I always pick up learnings from our guests, and hopefully you learned something new today. If you want to learn more about Chris Harrington, head over to genalpha.com. It's genalpha.com. If you want to learn more about Steve Rice, head over to .com, jungle.com. It's .com. If you want to learn more about Juliet Sampson, follow and connect with her on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about Laura Lai, head over to newgenarchitects.com. It's newgenarchitects.com. Links and more information will also be available in the show. If anything in this podcast resonated with you and your business, you might want to check other related episodes, including the interview with Hugo Fuentes, who shares the nuances of inventory turnover and how that could help optimize the inventory and cash flow. Also, the interview with Jeff Lam, who shares his insights on optimizing dock to stock ratio of a warehouse. Also, don't forget to subscribe and spread the word among folks with similar backgrounds. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please review and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform or DM me on any social channels. I'll try my best to respond personally and make sure you get help. Thank you, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of the WBS Podcast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the WBS Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform so you never miss an episode. For more information on growth strategies for SMBs using ERP and digital transformation, check out our community at wbs.rocks. We'll see you next time.